Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the attack on an Iranian military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz, which Iran's President Rouhani blames on the, quote, bully, the U.S. and its Gulf state allies for backing and enabling. Dr. Trita Parsi, a professor of international relations at Georgetown University, who has an article at Middle East Eye, is the Ahvaz terror attack aimed at dragging the U.S. into a larger war, joins us. We will discuss the competing pressures on Trump, who promised his base he would not dig the hole deeper for the U.S. in the Middle East and get into more wars, while at the same time being susceptible to Saudi money and the wishes of his biggest financial backer, Sheldon Adelson, who, along with Adelson's hero, Netanyahu, and the Saudi crown prince, would, as former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates warned, like to fight the Iranians to the last American. And while the Iranian economy is in freefall and the country is ripe for another people-power revolution against the corrupt ruling theocracy, military threats by hawks in the White House only play into the mullah's hands. Furthermore, with Putin now having buyer's remorse that his puppet in the White House is unstable enough to launch a war to distract the American people from the Mueller investigation, Russia's leader is privately warning the White House not to go to war against Iran, and if they do, Russia would back Iran. Then we'll examine the increasing political power of women's anger and the revolutionary rage galvanized around the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings as the all-male Republican Senate Judiciary Committee, quote, plows through the confirmation of an anti-choice corporatist judge who will move the Supreme Court to the far right for generations. Joining us is Christine Fair, a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, who has been singled out by Fox News and the Daily Caller for her profane tirades against Kavanaugh and the GOP, resulting in her address being published on white supremacist websites and wanted posters of her distributed on cars and tacked on trees in her neighborhood. Then finally, we'll look into how this sordid Washington drama is highlighting another ugly side of the thinking of many men about women, in which the boys will be boys defense of Kavanaugh sends the message that pushing women and teenage girls to have sex is a normal part of being a real man. Andrew Yarrow, a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute, whose latest book is Man Out, Men on the Sidelines of American Life, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Daily News, Kavanaugh, Sex, and Modern Masculinity, What the Standoff Reveals About Men in Our Culture. And joining us now, Dr. Trita Parsi, who's a professor of international relations at Georgetown University and the president emeritus of the National Iranian American Council and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. And he has an article at the Middle East Eye, Is the Ahvaz Terror Attack Aimed at Dragging the U.S. into a Larger War? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much.
And President Rouhani is on his way to the UN, as is Donald Trump. And Donald Trump will be chairing in the UN Security Council meeting on Wednesday, where he's apparently planning to talk about Iran. Rouhani vowed that Iran would not let this crime stand. We're talking about, of course, the attack on the IRGC military parade, the equivalent of Iran's Memorial Day parade in the southwest of the country, in Ahvaz. And Rouhani went on to say, it's absolutely clear to us who committed this crime and who they are linked to. They're supported by financial weaponry and political needs, and the small puppet countries in the region are backed by America, and the U.S. is provoking them and giving them the necessary capabilities. The U.S. showed the world their bullying nature, and they keep continuing their unilateral policies. So it's pretty clear who the Iranian government is blaming.
Certainly. And, you know, when it comes to the specific terrorist organization, they themselves have taken claimed responsibility for it. So on that, there's not much of a discussion. But whether the Saudis and the UAE had a finger in this and potentially the United States is, of course, a different matter. The Iranians have not presented any evidence, but the Saudis and the Emiratis themselves have kind of presented a degree of evidence. You have, or at least circumstantial evidence. You have an advisor to the Saudi, the UAE crown prince, who announced on Twitter yesterday that this is not a terrorist attack and that this is declared policy and that we should be expecting much more of this. You have the Saudi Crown Prince himself announcing about last year that he's going to take the fight inside of Iran, contrary to what it had been in the past, and meaning that he would be engaging in attacks inside of that country. You have members of the Trump administration declaring to Reuters that they have a policy of fomenting unrest in Iran. So with all of these different things happening, it's not as easy to dismiss the claim of the Iranian government that perhaps there is a Western angle and involvement in this.
But if this is a strategy that the Trump administration has, and there's no question that John Bolton is a uber hawk on Iran, and he stated many of the intentions which now are coming true, and his deputy has now been appointed by the Secretary of State Pompeo as the point person on Iran. So I can't understand their strategy. If Iran is going through economic hardship because of sanctions, renewed sanctions, the U.S. has apparently also leaned on European and others, and the investments are drying up. We know the economy is in this free fall in Iran. Why would you want to, if you're trying to destabilize this government and hope that the Iranian people will rise up and get rid of it as they did during the Green Revolution, or at least they attempted to do, if any military action will have the opposite effect, will it not? And if the U.S. fingerprints are found to be on this, won't that backfire in terms of the overall strategy, if indeed that is the strategy?
I think that's a very good question, and I think there's two different things here that needs to be addressed. On the one hand, it's important to recognize that the focus may not be on the regime. The focus is actually on the power of Iran. And from the perspective of some of the regional allies, it's not so much about whether Iran has this regime or not. They just want to see the balance of power in the region shift back towards them in the manner that it was prior to the invasion of Iraq. And that is something that you can achieve partly by destabilizing the country and creating chaos over there. But obviously a military confrontation would also be a way of being able to shift the balance of power back towards the favor of the UAE and Saudi Arabia. So for them to want this and go a little bit further than just economic sanctions and the devaluation of the Iranian currency fits well into that paradigm. The other thing that we also have to keep in mind is that as much as they're working in tandem, apparently, it's not entirely clear as to whether they're really on the same page. And I'm talking about the Trump administration, Saudi Arabia, UAE here. There seems to be a bit of an effort from the Arab allies of the United States to drag the United States into this confrontation. There certainly are voices inside of the White House that appear to be very sympathetic to this, obviously John Bolton. But Donald Trump himself seems to be a little bit more hesitant about this. And we've seen that the military action that he's taken thus far in Syria, for instance, have been very, very limited. He seems to be quite aware that a very significant portion of his base are very wary about additional wars in the Middle East. He partly won the elections because he campaigned on an end to these wars and saying that we should get ourselves out of the Middle East. So we have to keep that in mind as well, that there seems to be some different perspectives between the Saudis and the United States, and that this may be an effort to try to essentially trap the United States into a broader conflict.
We just learned in Sunday's New York Times, a front page story of how Sheldon Adelson has given the Trump administration or the Republicans $55 million to bolster their chances in the midterms. That's more money than the DNC has on hand by a major factor. He basically has made it clear, Adelson, that his greatest regret in his life is that he served in the U.S. Army and didn't serve in the Israeli Army, and Israel is his priority, and he installed Bolton, and it seems like he has an outside influence both over Netanyahu. He's formed a free newspaper in Israel to support. How much are his fingerprints on this? In other words, you've told us that Trump has made a promise not to get the U.S. into the Middle East, and his base is wary of any more losing wars in that neighborhood. But at the same time, he's a very transactional guy, and his biggest donor is Adelson. So Adelson surely has an outside influence.
He certainly has, and as you mentioned, he was the one who really pushed hard and convinced Trump to go with John Bolton. John Bolton is his guy, and he's liking everything he's seeing, from the moving of the embassy to killing the Iran deal. And we are in a geopolitical circumstance right now, which the Netanyahu government is looking at the region very similarly as the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and essentially fearing that the United States is going to be reducing its military presence in the region, abandoning the region, withdrawing from the region, which will then leave these countries having to face a geostrategic rivalry with Iran on their own without a powerful backer such as the United States. So from their perspective, dragging the U.S. back into the region, trapping it there, and making sure that it remains very much overcommitted to the Middle East lies in their interest. Now, I don't believe it lies in the U.S.'s interest, because from a global perspective, the U.S., the Middle East has lost a tremendous amount of strategic significance to the U.S., and Asia is the area where the U.S. is more or less undercommitted right now, and it needs to be able to reprioritize. But from the perspective of both the Saudis, the UAE, and Israel, they would like to see the U.S. strengthen its presence in the region and help it, them fight their own rivalries in the region. And with Trump, they have found someone that is very susceptible, not because he's necessarily convinced, but because he's so transactional, because he thinks that he can make political points with this, because he believes that he can get the Saudis to put a lot of money in the American economy if he does this. And that's where they are suddenly seeing that they have an opening that they certainly did not have with the Obama administration, and in their perspective would not also have had if Hillary Clinton had become president.
Well, I think the Woodward book makes clear and supports what you're saying, Dr. Rita Parsi, in terms of Trump wary of digging the hole deeper. He keeps asking, for example, why are we in Afghanistan? And frankly, these are good questions to ask. I wish more presidents asked those kind of questions rather than just go along with the conventional wisdom and dig the hole deeper, which seems to be the kind of inertia that we have. But
and on that point, if I could say two things. A couple of months ago, he held a press conference together with the prime ministers of the Baltic states. And he had a bit of a monologue there in which he was once again raising the issue, why are we in Syria? We spend $1.7 trillion on it. Nothing good has come out of it. Shouldn't we just send our women and men back home? And when he was saying this, a lot of people reacted saying, this is his instinct. This is his almost isolationist instinct. He doesn't want to be in the Middle East. But they didn't pay attention to what he said immediately thereafter. He said, a lot of countries are paying attention to our decision. The Saudis are paying a lot of attention to our decision. Well, if the Saudis want us to stay, perhaps they should pay. So suddenly, it wasn't just a person who may have had these instincts of getting out of the Middle East, but suddenly the instincts of a businessman who says, can I make money off of this? Can I get the Saudis to pay? And if they do so, I'll stay in Syria. And this is what is so fundamentally wrong with this, because if the United States is to be in Syria, it should be there because it lies in the national interest of the U.S. to be so. If it wants to leave, it should be because of the national interest of the U.S. dictates that it should leave. The size of the Saudi crown prince's pocketbook should have absolutely nothing to do with that decision.
Well, let's look at the broader picture in terms of whether or not the U.S. and the Israelis have sided, in effect, with the Sunni kings against the Shia regime in Iran and, by extension, in Syria and in Lebanon. And there is a sort of an alliance, if you will, with Russia and Iran and certainly Syria, the Assad regime, and the U.S. Just when you touch on the Baltics, by the way, Dr. Rita Parsi, there are reports that Vladimir Putin warned Secretary of State Mattis that he would use tactical nuclear weapons in the Baltics if it came to that. My understanding is that the Russians have given the Israelis a green light to pound the Iranians in Syria and in Lebanon. but not so much. They're certainly not giving the U.S. a green light to go to war against Iran and do a wag the dog war, which apparently Putin's concerned. You know, he may well have put Trump in the White House, but now he wonders whether it was worth it because the man is so unstable. My understanding is that the Russians have already warned the U.S. that they would side with Iran in any wider war with between the U.S. and its proxies and Iran.
I'm not so sure what the specific wording has been in the conversations between Putin and Trump, but certainly the Russians do not want to see more governments in the Middle East tilt towards the United States. So as a result, they're not going to allow the Assad regime to fall and be replaced by a pro-American government. And certainly in the case of Iran, that's too important of a geopolitical player. The Russians may make deals with the Israelis. They may be sympathetic to some of the Israeli arguments that they don't want Iranian forces to be too close to their borders. But if the Israeli action were to address the broader conflict in Syria in such a way that it would be a threat to the survival of the Assad regime, then I suspect that you would see the Russians adopting a very different posture. But if it's just targeting the Iranians and it's not really changing the situation in Syria dramatically, but it pushes back the Iranians further away from the Israeli border, then it seems like the Russians are pretty okay with that, and they also use it as a way of putting pressure on Iran themselves. But in a broader picture, I think you're quite right. I have a very hard time seeing that the Russians would go along with a broader war that could result in both Iran as well as Syria ending up having regime collapse and then be replaced by pro-Western regimes.
Well, but when you look at, as you mentioned earlier, that it's not just the animus between the Saudi crown prince and his mentor, MBZ, in the Emirates, who want to bring down the Iranian regime, and as former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, that the Saudis and the Israelis want to fight the Iranians to the last American. In terms of an own goal, to use a soccer term, it would seem that the Yemen war is an own goal for the Saudis and the Emiratis. They're just absolutely going nowhere, and they spent billions of dollars. The reason why Iran has emerged largely as a dominant power in that region is because the U.S. took out Iraq and essentially handed it to Iran. So how much of this is has the U.S. and the Saudis brought this situation on themselves, which now they think the only way to rectify is to either destabilize or invade Iran?
Well, it's actually very interesting what you're saying, because you're quite right. What they're doing can be seen as own goals, and it certainly is destabilizing the region. But I think to a certain extent it's deliberate. It's precisely because the fact that the Yemen war is not going well that the Saudis believe that they can drag the United States into it, essentially saying the U.S. needs to come in and fix this now. It's precisely because things elsewhere in the region have not gone so well and the Saudis have exasperated the situation that they think that they can compel the United States, that if the U.S. doesn't come in, the region is going to become either completely chaotic or it's going to end up being under the control of American rivals such as Iran or Russia. And this is why I think there is a deep amount of frustration in the U.S. military. You do hear it when they speak privately, that they feel that the Saudis are constantly trying to trap the United States into a much, much deeper military engagement in the region at a time when most strategists in the United States believe that the U.S. is overcommitted as it is right now to the Middle East and needs to actually significantly reduce its military fingerprints.
But at the end of the day, the Saudi agenda goes so much beyond what these machinations we're talking about. For example, they're still spending tons of money in Indonesia. They're building madrasas and universities to radicalize Islam and, you know, impose the kind of Wahhabi version of Islam around the world. And, you know, if you think about what happened in Syria, for example, there's no question the Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran are a hideous bunch. And when Assad
was shooting his own people in the streets when they were rising up. His own military started to fracture because they didn't want to kill their own people, and they brought in the IRGC to murder the people in the streets because they're so ruthless. So then what happens? The Saudis bring in all the damn jihadis. And the minute they brought the jihadis in, you could argue Assad won the war. He got the moral high ground, if you could use the word moral in that hideous war. How do you see it?
Well, certainly, the if you take a look at how the Iranians have been using militias and have been developing alliances in the region, they have strong alliances with organizations like Hezbollah, which they also had a role in putting into existence. Their relationship with groups like Hamas, etc., are much more transactional. There's not at all the same level of trust. But you don't have a situation in which any one of the organizations that the Iranians are associated with in the last 40 years really have betrayed Iran, or that that relationship has collapsed. When you take a look at how the Saudis are putting together proxy groups, etc., you see a dramatically different picture. A very common pattern is that within 6 months, those organizations turn on Saudi Arabia and start attacking Saudi Arabia, and then Saudi Arabia claims that it's an enemy of those groups, even though it actually played a critical role in their founding, particularly through ideological and financial help. That is the case with Al-Qaeda, and that is also the case with ISIS. And the Saudis have, as you mentioned, poured in Nusra and other fighters. There were moments in which the Saudis actually went into their own jails and released Saudi radicals that they had imprisoned, because they don't want them in Saudi Arabia. They prefer them to be elsewhere. And essentially, the offer was that you'll be released if you go to Syria and fight, and there would be a win-win for the Saudis, because either they would be killing some Alawites and Bashar Assad troops, and that would be a win for Saudi Arabia, or they would get killed themselves, which also would be a win for Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis have had a long history of actually exporting their problems to the rest of the region, and having first radicalizing people and then seeing them as a threat and then sending them elsewhere in the region so that they can be a threat over there rather than being a threat back in Saudi Arabia.
Well, Dr. Tridipathy, we could talk about our best friends, the Saudis, further, but it sort of sickens me to think about it. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tridipathy, who's a professor of international relations at Georgetown University and the president emeritus of the National Iranian American Council and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. And he has an article at the Middle East Eye, Is the Avaaz Terror Attack Aimed at Dragging the U.S. Into a Larger War? And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the increasing political power of women's anger and the revolutionary rage galvanized around the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who's the Provost Distinguished Associate Professor in the Security Studies Program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and has served as a senior fellow at the West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. And her most recent book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and she speaks and reads Hindu, Urdu, and Punjabi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, thank you, Christine. We're not going to be talking about your specialty in Afghanistan and Pakistan and India, but rather the extent to which you've been singled out by Fox News and Daily Caller, and that your address has been published on white supremacist websites, and wanted posters of you have been distributed on cars and tacked on trees in your neighborhood because of your outspoken criticism of the GOP and lately Judge Kavanaugh. So we've spoken before about how you took on the white supremacists, effectively the head of America's neo-Nazis, Spencer, in your gym and got him booted out. And I remember in a previous conversation you referred to the GOP as the Grab Our Pussy Party. So
are you allowed to use that word? Will you get fined for using that word?
Well, the Christian right did push through a set of restrictions on the FCC have placed on public radio. There's a number of words you can't use, but I believe that is
including
not...
Including the words that are used by our president.
Right, exactly.
Quite ironic. You have to censor the president's own words.
Yeah. Now that's not one of them, but we have to be careful because it's something like a $250,000 fine, and obviously it's designed to put public radio out of business rather than protect tender ears. So what is... give us a sense of where this gathering storm of women's rage is heading here, because it's quite palpable, and it's obviously when Mitch McConnell says we're going to plow this thing through, there is a determination, obviously, and even if Dr. Blasey Ford is able to testify, I'm sure they're going to railroad her one way or the other. And they're going to put this guy on the court. They did that with Merrick Garland. They denied him. They held up most of Obama's judicial nominees so that now under Trump they could stack the courts. They know, the Republicans, that the odds are that they'll control the Senate forever and therefore control the judiciary. So in a broader sense, American democracy is for the opposition, the Democrats, is getting narrower and narrower. Their only hope to have any political power in the future is to control the presidency and the House.
Well, and of course, controlling the presidency as our demographics continue to shift towards urban areas and the coast will become increasingly difficult because of the slave state college. I think if we were going to talk about the state of American democracy, we have to basically countenance the first fact that while many parliamentary democracies have equal power in the higher house for their federating units, those parliamentary democracies do not bestow the upper house with all of the power. Typically, the power to appoint secretaries and judicial posts lie with the lower house. And so we have this really appalling situation in the United States whereby in 2040, two-thirds of the Senate is going to be controlled by about 30% of the population. About two-thirds of the Senate will be controlled by 30% of the population. And that 30% of the population, of course, is going to be in the heartless land, some of the most backward-looking troglodytes. And I don't really see how this is sustainable unless we're able to have massive electoral reform where the sweeping powers of the Senate are given to the House, which is a more representative body, even though the representativeness of that body is hobbled by things like gerrymandering. Where I live in Virginia, it's legal to gerrymander per political party. So you don't have to concoct difficult proxies such as race. You can simply go by the metric that matters and basically group Democrats into districts that don't matter or where our votes are consolidated into a minimum number of votes. And then, of course, we also have very clear efforts of voter restriction, which are aimed at people of color. So unless Americans understand that, A, we are not currently a democracy, and we never have been, right? That's a fact I don't think most Americans appreciate. But the very potential for this country to ever be a democracy and to see our democratic promise fructify, we need enormous electoral reforms. And I think those electoral reforms become ever more impossible as the GOP asserts its backward-looking stranglehold upon virtually all levers of power in this country, And obviously, I think the most important over time, because we have another unusual situation, our Supreme Court justices have a lifetime appointmentship. Very few democracies do that for the reasons that it is so, in fact, dangerous. So I'm frustrated when I hear millennials say, oh, you know, my vote doesn't matter. And I want to say to them, you know, in 30 years, I'm going to be in the old folks home, probably not in this country because of the cost of health care for the elderly. You're going to be dealing with this situation. So get your butts out and vote. Your vote matters. Your vote matters more than mine, because in 30 years, you are going to pay the consequences of your insouciance, not me. I'll either be dead or someplace else.
Well, arguably, we've got a little more than 40 days left to save America, because if this Kavanaugh gets on the Supreme Court, and if the Democrats don't take the House and perhaps the Senate, I think it's all over for the country, given the trajectory that it's on. And, you know,
it's absolutely over.
But clearly, when you talk about the red states, the minority, that's very much the subtext here with getting Kavanaugh, and they've made it clear, the Republicans, that the Christian right that backs them would be furious if they dropped the ball and he didn't get through. And of course, on the other side, the 1% want Kavanaugh because he's a representative of the elite and the powerful and the rich, as are most of these appointees now, certainly all the Republican ones. And of course, he's a zealous corporatist as well. So you can see how the rich and powerful want him and how the Christian right want him. But absolutely, isn't there something fundamental about what's going on here with this anti-abortion thing? And I know people think it's somehow it's too much of an issue, but it seems to be at the heart of it, because what the religious right is really about is patriarchy. And what they're really about is the idea that they want to give rights to fetuses and the unborn over the rights of the women that are carrying them. And it's never made any sense, but it does make sense if you look at history. Women, of course, who died in childbirth, the child was always saved at the expense of the woman. Of course, in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, he was plucked untimely from his mother's womb. So this is what it's about, and it's not that far from The Handmaid's Tale, the attitudes of these scolds in the religious right.
So, I mean, let's put a very empirical point upon this. We can lay waste to the canard that the anti-abortion movement is, in fact, pro-life. And how can we demonstrate that this is, in fact, a devious ruse? Well, one, if they truly cared about the child that a fetus will become, they would support, of course, comprehensive health care for the mother prenatally, antenatally, and during the course of her pregnancy. If they cared about children's lives, they wouldn't, of course, without question, support comprehensive, free child care, health care for children. They would be much more interested in gun control. The most likely way in which your child is going to die in school is through a mass shooting with a handgun. And in some sense, you know, I like to point out that these AR-15 deaths are really extreme late-term abortions. So we can look at the whole range of their other policies, and we can discern very quickly that this isn't about pro-life. This isn't about being pro-child. It's really about being anti-woman. They understand fully well that the fundamental control over a woman's fecundity is not only the secret to our political and social empowerment, it's about our access to economic justice. And in their Leave It to Beaver imagination, they believe that women having the right to control our fecundity is what allowed us to leave the house, which is what allowed us to stand up to abusive husbands. And of course, they are absolutely right. The difference between me and my mother is that my mother couldn't leave her abusive husband. If my husband dared abuse me, I would kick him out in a femtosecond, because I am independently financially capable of taking care of myself. And they understand this. And this is what this is about. And I think anyone that says otherwise is completely nonsensical. I don't know if you remember this. Paul Ryan had the hubris to say that women should be producing more babies because it would be good for our economy. And I want to point out that this might actually be true, but many countries in Europe that face a demographic crisis. They have been financially incentivizing women to give birth. Think about that for a second. My sister-in-law actually gave birth in Germany. She actually got her entire year's salary while she was off taking care of her infant. They understood that reproductive labor is labor that should be compensated. But in the United States, it's just the opposite. There are countless statistical studies that show that when women have children, our competitive wages go down relative to women who have no children. When and by the way, there was also a marriage tax that we paid. When women got married, our wages went down. When men get married, guess what? Their wages go up. And the reason, of course, for this is that women are in various ways subsidizing men's productivity while we are foregoing our own. So in other words, from beginning to end, we are penalized for being a female. And I'm going to be very explicit about the math here. At one point, I sat down with my husband, and I knew the math. I'd already done the math. You know, I started my PhD in molecular biophysics about chemistry. I can do math. But I wanted my husband to endogenize the impacts of him marrying a woman instead of another white male. First, I had him calculate what's the tax of maintaining my vagina. Now, if you just add up in then-year dollars the amount that you pay in tampons and pads and new underwear, it only comes to, say, $7,000. But that's not the way you do it, of course. You have to do this in an investment cycle, kind of like what they did when you were in the eighth grade. You put a dollar in. Over the course of the next 60 years, you have $1 million. So what appears to be just a couple of thousand dollars actually ends up being tens of thousands of dollars. Our wage differential, and I had my husband do this math as well, when I was hired at $10,000 less than a male who was less qualified than me, over the course of 13 years, that $10,000 became between $300 and $5,000, depending upon whether you use a conservative rate in the stock market or a more aggressive rate of return for the stock market. And my husband, I asked him, I said, when we aggregate the actual cost that you have basically endogenized by marrying a white female, how many more years do you have to work to retire? And I don't think my husband had ever, because he kept saying to me, why are you so angry all the time? Why are you so furious? And my husband, I said, now, Jeff, tell me, do you share my rage? And I have to say, for the first time in our 15 years of marriage, my husband understood it. Because I was able to monetize it for him and translate it into years that he has to work. And I said, if you had married another white man, you could retire about 7 years earlier.
Well, we know that between 50 and 60% of U.S. households are headed by women who are the primary breadwinners. So what you've just told us, Christine Fair, is even more it's even a greater penalty that the fact of the matter being that between 50 and 60% of the country's households are headed by women who are the major breadwinners. I mean, that's extraordinary.
What I've been saying to my male associates and friends and colleagues, I said, you know, rights really are not like pizza or pie. When I get mine, you don't get less. And in fact, you should be arguing for equal pay for equal work because it enhances the economic well-being of your household. You can retire sooner if women are not discriminated upon the basis of our gender. And I have so much data on this. I mean, I could literally, now of course data are considered hocus pocus witchcraft by the faux noise constituents. But the literature on this is so profound, it is absolutely irrefutable. We are less likely to be hired. We are less likely to be promoted. We are less likely to be compensated. If we are pregnant, we are less likely to be hired again because employers suspect, not inaccurately, I may add, that we will be the primary care providers for our children, that when the kids get sick, it's going to be wifey poo that has to take time off work, not her highfalutin husband. And so the penalties that we pay for our fecundity are enormous. And it's, like I said, it's really a different approach than, say, some of the European countries that look at the demographic crisis, that they have that their family structures, they're not even at the replacement rate, and that's why immigration is, of course, so important for Europe. But if you're really at this point where women need to be encouraged to become pregnant, you need to incentivize us positively. What the United States has basically tried to do has just tried to make us engage in forced labor, and at the risk of sounding preposterous, I want to remind people that forced labor is actually slavery.
Well, just in the last minute, let's turn back to Kavanaugh and women's rights. How do you see this playing out? If he is pushed through onto the court, that will anger people, but it will also do in lasting damage to our lives. Our rights will be taken away one by one. And, of course, corporations will be empowered. Consumers will have no power. The rich will have even more power over the poor. And that is just the way it's clearly heading, and that's why they want this guy in there. So how do you see this working out? I mean, obviously, it would be better to try and stop him if we could, but the math is not on the side of the opposition, the Democrats.
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think what Orrin Hatch, of all of the chicanery and nonsense that I have seen oozing out of the apparently oral orifices of the Vichy GOP's mouth, is Orrin Hatch. Orrin Hatch says specifically, even if the rape allegation was true, it wouldn't matter. He's still a good guy. He has to be judged on the basis of who he is today. And of course, who he is today, if this rape was true, is a rapist who absconded. And in my experience, no one starts out sexually assaulting women in high school, get away with it, and then conclude, oh, gee, I shouldn't do that again. What they actually conclude from that is that they can do that with impunity. I know there are other women out there who've experienced this. But having seen what's happened, Dr. Ford, they would be foolish if they want to come out. She has been threatened. Her family's been threatened. Her entire life has been upended. She is an American hero, not Kavanaugh. And I can tell you, I mean, I'm just as a woman who is very vocal, who doesn't demur from controversy, who is plain spoken and speaks truth, even when people don't want to hear the truth. I know the kinds of assault to which I have been subjected. I can't, without you running afoul of your censors, even tell you the emails that I've received in the last about 48 hours. I received about 200 emails, all but four of which have come from men, all of which have been rapist, rapacious, and racist. And I can only imagine that it will be multiple scalars of difference, the kinds of abuse that Dr. Ford is receiving. So any other women, it's a rare woman that is going to basically be willing to change her life, knowing that the likelihood of her testimony is going to change things. It's going to be like basically micturating in the ocean and expecting the water level to change, because it's very clear that no matter what the truth is, they're not interested in the truth. And this underlines, I think, the fundamental problem that we have with today's GOP is that they have no regard for women. They view us as second class. They don't even have to take our vote for granted, because there are so many structural systems in our voting system that privilege a GOP outcome. And even if you're the GOP, you might bargain that you might take a hit in some elite constituencies in this upcoming election, but your game is to transform the court. And you're not, and by the way, for them, transforming the court basically means depriving women, people of color, ethnic and religious minorities, LGBTQI, and anyone that is not a corporation of our due rights. And they're not going to let this opportunity go. So I think it's right that we continue to protest. My fear is that even if the Democrats were to take back the House or the Senate, they are so pusillanimous that they will not reopen this. In the same way that they will not even consider impeaching Trump, they will not even consider impeaching Kavanaugh. And I will add that there's already grounds for him to be impeached from his current position, because he perjured himself at least four times during his testimony. This is the most flagrant message that the GOP doesn't care about the vast majority of this country. It cares about the 30% of this country who are white males. And not only that, a subset of those white males that are rich like they are.
Well, Christine Farah, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Christine Farah, a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan and served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. And we are going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into how the Boys Will Be Boys defense of Kavanaugh sends the message that pushing women and teenage girls to have sex is a normal part of being a real man.
Good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andrew Yarrow, who's a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute, who has been a New York Times reporter, a Labor Department speechwriter, and has worked for the Brookings Institution, and has been a U.S. history professor at American University. And his latest book is Man Out, Men on the Sidelines of American Life. And he has an article at the New York Daily News, Kavanaugh, Sex and Modern Masculinity, What the Standoff Reveals About Men in Our Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Yarrow.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And it seems that there are two sort of strains here to the sort of toxic masculinity, in the sense that the supporters of Kavanaugh amongst men in the GOP and in the red states, I think, are largely the men that you write about in your book, in the sense that they see themselves as marginalized and endangered and losing their privileges. But then on the other side, the men who support him and want Kavanaugh on the court, he is being groomed as a part of the right-wing corporate elite, has he not? And that is, while he will do the religious rights bidding and ban abortion, he will also be a faithful corporatist and serve the interests of the powerful over the powerless.
You're certainly right, Ian, that he's a defender of corporate interests as well as an opponent of women's reproductive rights, of many kinds of rights. But as I get into in my article, what's really, or one of the many troubling pieces about this is, you know, what this whole situation or affair reveals about masculinity in America today, or traditional masculinity. And, you know, I talk about how the whole so much of the defense of Kavanaugh comes down to, at least implicitly, in some cases explicitly, the boys will be boys kind of attitude, which is downright crazy. But then, you know, as your last guest brought up as well, the fact that Dr. Ford has received, you know, death threats, sexual threats, all sorts of online threats, you know, is part of a larger phenomenon of growing misogyny, particularly online in the culture in America. And the final piece in terms of masculinity, and I have a lot more to say about masculinity broadly, but apropos of the Kavanaugh case, is the nature of lying. That you look at the history of, I mean, just the last 20 years or so of, you know, men lying about sexual misconduct. It's you don't hear women lying about these issues. I mean, there's some research out there that when women lie, on average, you know, it's more like, my, don't you look good today, whereas when men lie, and again, this is a gross overgeneralization, but on average, when men lie, it's to protect themselves, it's to, you know, keep them away from shame for something that they've done. And I think that's clearly playing out in the Kavanaugh case and with Kavanaugh. And you also make a point about certainly he plays to, and these traditional masculine ideals or norms play to a conservative America. But what I found in writing my book was in many ways more troubling, that a lot of people who should be progressives or call themselves progressives have, at best, mixed feelings about women, men, who I interviewed. That it's a very interesting study by a group called Promundo, a gender equity group, of young men, millennial men, and their views of masculinity. And, you know, big majorities came out believing that, you know, men, there should be gender equity, feminism is a good thing. But then when they were followed up with the question of how would you behave, a similar large majority said, well, I feel I get the messages, and, you know, there's lots of peer pressure that, you know, a guy has to be tough. A guy has to have as many sexual partners as possible. A guy can't cry. You know, all the sort of traditional nonsense. And, you know, beyond that, when talking with a lot of men who describe themselves as progressives and feminists, many would say, yes, feminism has done a lot of good for women, but it's left many men confused. And, or I'd hear the response to the effect that, well, feminism is good. It's only those, quote, radical feminists, unquote, who are bad, which, you know, who are the radical feminists?
I was going to say that it's particularly depressing that we have a liar in chief who just lies all the time, and setting it as a role model. And of course, when he was confronted with, I think, 16, 19 women or so came forth and said that they'd been sexually harassed or assaulted by him. You know, his appeal to his base was, yeah, he doesn't deny the fact that he's a womanizer. He doesn't even, he's almost proud of it. And of course, that tape from Access Hollywood, right on the record there, he's basically boasting about sexual harassment. But I guess you have to throw him in with this whole lot. You've got Bill Clinton, of course, he lied because he was concerned about his wife finding out. Newt Gingrich lied about sex. John Edwards lied. Mark Stanford lied. Gary Hart lied. So it's a bipartisan problem. But the difference with women is it's not just that they don't lie. They also have to hold in this pain, sometimes for decades and decades, in the way that a lot of young Catholic boys and girls have been holding in their pain about the abuse of priests. Patty Reagan came forth and talked about holding her pain in for decades as well. And that's apparently what Christine Blasey Ford has done as well. So that's a pretty profound difference, is it not, between the victim and the victimizer. The victim suffers, and the victimizer, if he's someone like Donald Trump, he's you know, proud as a peacock.
Or he just writes it off as, you know, some horseplay as a, you know, a teenager, a 20-something, whatever. It's certainly not something that an awful lot of men feel regret about. And as you say, I mean, women hold these, you know, terrible memories, these tragic memories for all their lives, but for decades. And as we've seen with Dr. Ford and the Patty Davis column today, that, it's perfectly understandable that women are not going to come out and talk about these things. And, you know, I know of many personal cases, people I know, women I know who...
Well, just in closing then, the last couple of minutes, in terms of your book, Man Out, Men on the Sidelines of American Life, what's going to change this phony victimhood? Because, the deck's still stacked in men's favor, yet they feel victimized. You know, it's crazy.
Well, it's a somewhat more nuanced story. Men in many cases have, you know, created the problems that we're facing, but there are also a lot of men who are facing problems that are a result of a bad economy, a result of, you know, a culture that sends out wrong messages, the fact that, you have issues that men are in particularly poor health. You have more than triple the suicide rate among men than women, more than double the drug overdose rate. And then you have all this anger. I mean, not just toward women, but toward employers, toward the system. And, you know, you see some of that in this 24 percentage point gender voting gap in 2016, which could be larger this year. But there's also data out there that men are 50% less likely to trust the government than women. So, you know, there's a lot of anger among a lot of men. And while these may be, you know, certainly not all men, and there are an awful lot out there. And I guess I want to say that in my book, I look at men as sort of neither purely victims or culprits. I mean, there are ways in which I think they have been victimized, as I say, by an economic system that's unjust. You know, even though it's entirely true that women still have the short end of the stick, that doesn't mean that, you know, other people who have a somewhat longer end of the stick but are still suffering should be ignored. And, that's one thing I'm trying to bring attention to, that, you know, some of these men are jerks in their behavior. Some of these men, you know, are just having a real hard time in life, and they're acting it out in ways that aren't great, and working.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, Andrew, but I appreciate you joining us very much.
Well, thank you so much, Ian. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Yarrow, who's a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He's also been a New York Times reporter, a Labor Department speechwriter, has worked for the Brookings Institution, and has been a U.S. history professor at American University. And his latest book is Man Out, Men on the Sidelines of American Life. And he has an article at the New York Daily News, Kavanaugh, Sex and Modern Masculinity, What the Standoff Reveals About Men in Our Culture. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.